Good day, and welcome to today's Rural Health Clinics Technical Assistance National Teleconference. Ask the experts, RHC consultants answer your questions. As a reminder, this call is being recorded. If you do have a question at any time, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure that your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open to ask a question, and please state your name and your city and state location when you ask your question. Once again, that is star 1 if you'd like to ask a question. And at this time, I would like to turn the conference over to your host, Bill Fannerfox. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, operator, and I appreciate everyone joining us today for this different kind of a Rural Health Clinic technical assistance call. For those of you who participated in the past, you know, our usual format is to have a speaker and then take questions on that topic at the end. Based on a lot of the traffic on the Rural Health Clinic listserv and others, we thought maybe this would be an opportunity to give an open mic night or open mic day, if you will. As I said, I'm Bill Fannerfrock, and I'm the Executive Director of the National Association of Rural Health Clinics, and I'll be the moderator for today's call. Joining us today on the call as our experts are some RHC billing, coding, cost reporting, and survey and certification folks who've been involved in this field for a long time. We have Jeff Johnson, who is with Whipley CPAs and Consultants, Ron Nelson with Health Services Associates, Barry Martin with MRT Consulting, Charles James with North American Healthcare Management, Glenn Biesink with Midwest Healthcare, and Jim Estes with Healthcare Horizons. As I said, this will be an open line opportunity. We do have some questions that were submitted ahead of time, and we'll alternate back and forth between those that you have when you get in the queue and those that were submitted ahead of time. This series is sponsored by the Health Resources and Services Administration's Federal Office of Rural Health Policy in conjunction with the National Association of Rural Health Clinics. The purpose of the series is to provide RHC staff with valuable technical assistance and RHC-specific information. Today's call is the 36th call in the series, which began in late 2004. During that time, over 9,000 individuals have participated on this national teleconference series. As you all know, there's no charge to participate. We encourage you to refer others who might benefit from this series to sign up to receive announcements regarding call dates, topics, and presentations. If you want information, you can go to www.ruralhealth.hrsa.gov/RHC. We do ask that when your line is open and you ask your question, that you identify yourself with your name, your city, and state that you're calling from before asking your question. So without further ado, we'd like to begin this process, and I'll start off so that you can now get folks have an opportunity to get into the queue to ask your questions with some of the questions, with one of the questions that was submitted ahead of time. This comes from Shannon Stickford. Shannon asks, are provider-based RHCs a facility for purposes of secondary billing? How would you guys like to answer that?
An RHC for the purpose provider-based, you know, I don't think for the secondary claims that they're most likely going to recognize it as a facility. And I had seen the question before the session, and it went on to ask about billing these claims on a UB versus a 1500, and they're getting rejections, et cetera. Unfortunately, I think it's going to come down to each individual payer. I don't think there's, you know, for example, some payers are not going to take the secondary claim on a UB. Some payers will indeed say this is a non-covered service as a facility. You're not going to pay the claim. In this case,
they went on, they described their situation. They said, daily we deal with problems of rejected claims. Our contract with the, when we bill a physician claim, because our Medicare EOB is in a facility format. Our contract with the other payers is as a physician, so we bill as a physician. Doesn't the outpatient prospective payment guidelines classify as a Part B physician service whose claims are only processed by a Part A intermediary?
I had to pass on the PPS.
Okay. Anybody else want to take? And also, if you guys would identify yourselves, that was Charles James with North American. Any of the other folks want to take a crack at it? They go on to say, we've heard of a few providers that bill the secondary claims in a UB institutional format, with the HCPCS RHC code, and then the patient has high out-of-pocket costs or non-covered services, while most others bill as a physician and deal with the various problems of the secondary, confused with a physician claim with an institutional EOB. Is there a right and a wrong way legally?
This is still Charles. I just go on to amend my statement. I think the problem with the way the question is phrased and the issue that creates a lot of confusion is that even though we're rural health clinics, the mechanism is all Part A facility. It's really to the patients. It's still a Part B,
right?
Claim. So that's going to go to their Part B deductible or coinsurance. So, while I can't answer the legality of the outpatient prospective payment system, I think the confusion is that we're Part A with a Part B label slapped on it, and it does create a lot of confusion. So where we've had to deal with this, we call up the payer and say, hey, you may not like the remit like it is, but at the end of the day, Medicare says this is the amount of deductible or this amount of the coinsurance, and here it is on the remit. What are your requirements for the claim?
Okay.
This is Jeff Johnson from Whipley. And I think the question was intended to be all-encompassing. And essentially, my presumption here is that we have a rural health clinic that is provider-based to a PPS hospital. In other words, not a critical access hospital, but a hospital that gets paid on APC services for outpatient claims and so forth. But that doesn't really apply in this situation because the rural health clinic itself is a different type of entity or provider-based entity to the hospital. And that, in my opinion, how I would treat that is that those secondary, just like Charles said, I agree with Charles that the secondary claims are a case-by-case basis depending on the payer. But certainly you want to either, if the secondary claim accepts the UB, great. If not, what I have seen other rural health clinics do or what other clinics do is they'll just provide that service as a place of service code 11, if you will, on a 1500 form and run it through Part B to get the crossover or whatever the case may be.
Okay. All right. Operator, anybody else want to contribute or add in on that? If not, we'll move on to our first question from the callers. Okay. Operator, you want to take our first question?
As a reminder, that is star one if you have a question, and we'll take our first question. Caller, please go ahead.
I think that's me. This is Janie Elliott, and I was just responding to that to the issue of the secondaries. What has happened is WPS, which happens to be my intermediary, forwards those in the UB format. What I'm hearing from my insurance companies is they won't accept it that way. So I just automatically drop my claim as a 1500 and attach my EOB, my Medicare EOB, and send it to the individual companies, and it gets paid.
And Jenny, yep. Where are you located?
In Harrisonville, Missouri.
Okay.
That's precisely what we see happen the most commonly.
And a lot of these problems started when I think it was in October of last year when Medicare started forwarding all of our secondary claims just automatically, which they've stopped now, but that's beside the point. And then, my Coventry and my Blue Cross and Blue Shield started rejecting them, saying, no, this is a facility because it came in on a UB format. So
right.
I just drop it to a 1500 and mail it.
That's a good approach.
Okay. Jenny, did you have a question, or you just wanted to add to the conversation?
No, actually, I do have a question, and my question is involving labs that are done in a provider-based clinic. We did a quick view influenza, quick wave test in the clinic. The patient was then referred to the hospital for a stat CBC. So my claim went in on one form for my quick view influenza. Then the hospital billed a CBC and chem panel on a separate claim form. Now they're editing out. Is there a condition code or something that I can add to my lab so that it will tell them that it was done in two separate places? Because it's provider-based, they're both being billed under the same provider number.
So if I can understand the question correctly, this is Jeff again, the lab service was not billed on the RHC bill type, but billed on the, are you a
hospital provider number, yes.
Okay, critical access or
yes,
PPS?
Yes, critical access.
Okay, so that lab service, along with the other lab service, should be all billed on the same claim form, an 851 bill type, and you should get cost reimbursement for that.
But there's no way to get them on the same claim form because we bill our rural health clinic services through a separate billing service.
What needs to happen is those lab services need to be, if you have a separate practice management system that you're billing
right.
the rural clinic services from, what
right.
needs to happen is those labs need to basically somehow be taken off your practice management system and added to the hospital practice
and added to the hospital. Okay.
Yep.
Okay, so otherwise, if I can't get that done, then it is appropriate that I just write the lab off in the rural health clinic, right?
Well, I wouldn't write the lab off. I would make sure you can get the service billed on the hospital.
Well,
on the
I'm gonna do my best to figure out a process, but I'm talking about a 30-mile difference from my critical access hospital, and so
sure.
sometimes that the communication piece is hard.
Right.
But so okay, then that's what I needed to know.
No problem.
Thank you.
Thanks, Janie. Our next question came from, and I apologize if I don't pronounce the name correctly, Joy Auer. Joy writes, please clarify, other than the IPPE visit, if a patient is being seen in an RHC for preventative care only and having a routine pap and breast exam where it has been 2 years since her previous exam, is the visit considered a billable RHC encounter? We've been advised that preventative care is considered a billable RHC encounter. Is this correct?
Yes. If it's within the two, this is Charles, within the, you know, biennial PAP, then basically the professional piece is going to go as an RHC encounter, and any of the technical components are going to go fee-for-service. But if it's according to Medicare's preventive services schedule, then, yes, that should be an encounter.
So those would be qualified as a face-to-face encounter, presumably it's with a covered or recognized provider and a medically necessary service.
Correct.
Okay. Anybody else want to add to that or any more? Okay.
I might add that there's a really good resource that CMS has put out the last few years. It's called the, I might get the name wrong, but it's on CMS's website, the Medicare Guide to Preventative Services. And it has a lot of great information on there for those preventative covered Medicare services. And it even tells you how to bill it if you're a PPS hospital, a physician's, you know, just a regular clinic, an independent rural health clinic, or a provider-based rural health clinic.
Okay. All right, we'll see if we can't get a link to that, and if we can, we'll put it out on the listserv. Operator, we'll take our next question from the callers.
Caller, please go ahead.
Yes, our question is that we...
Give your name and where you're calling from.
Betsy from Florida. And we're at a rural health clinic, and we have nursing home patients in an adjacent county. Are we allowed to bill those through our rural health clinic, which is in an adjacent county?
This is Jim Estes with Healthcare Horizon. I have a lot of clients that do that, and I'm not aware of any issue with the clinic, as long as you're billing them through a clinic, which is in the shortage area and is a rural health clinic. The patient's location could be in another county. In fact, I know of some that are in a larger city that they are able to provide those services. But this was several years ago I got clarification from what was then Riverbend, and the patient's address is not really an issue. It's the location of the clinic through which the services are being provided.
But the individuals in that nursing home have to be rural health clinic patients?
Absolutely.
In other words,
that does not mean
that how do they document that that's an RHC patient as opposed to somebody that they've gone and said, hey, we'd really like to get a higher reimbursement rate. We want you to come in and see our patients and get them covered as rural health clinic patients.
Well, the rural health clinic patient establishment is basically opening a chart on that patient. So you would have a medical chart with documentation to support all the services provided to that patient in the nursing home that were billed as a rural health encounter. So anytime a billing goes out from that clinic, you better have documentation to show that it was medically necessary and that it was a patient of the clinic, and the services were provided by a medical provider who's on the staff of the Rural Health Clinic. In other words, they're in the cost report. Their cost is there in the Rural Health Clinic cost report.
All right.
Bill.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, go ahead.
Bill, can I add something to that? It's Glenn.
Okay.
I think the key thing about nursing homes that we need to remember is exactly what Jim said. A lot of doctors go to the nursing home, see a patient, and the chart remains at the nursing home. That will not work in a rural health clinic. They'll have to have a chart in the rural health clinic to establish that patient as a nursing home patient. So they actually have to have a duplicate chart. The other thing is remember that that nursing home must be located in a health professional shortage area, because you, in Florida, for instance, you may have a rural health clinic attached to an urban area that's not a HPSA. And it is my understanding that the nursing home must be located in a health professional shortage area, no different than the person's place of residency would have to be in a health professional shortage area. There's something in the reg somewhere, but I have to.
Jim, you would take issue with that?
This is Ron Nelson responding.
Okay, Ron. Go ahead.
I disagree. There's nothing in the regs that show that there's a requirement of the residence of the nursing home patient has to be in a HPSA. It doesn't exist in the regs. The test is still what Jim pointed out, which is there evidence of a record in the rural health clinic? Is it performed by a rural health clinic provider? And is it medically necessary? And the fact that the nursing home may be in another county, as long as that's a patient of the rural health clinic that exists and is in a HPSA, there's no requirement for residency relative to nursing home patients.
Okay. I want to point out here that much of this for things, there's not always a clear black and white piece of paper that says what is or is not correct. And one of the reasons we wanted to have a number of different consultants is that there are differences of opinion at times on what how one may choose to interpret or what a policy may say. And the answers that folks here are offering are based on their experience with the program. I realize that as an audience that sometimes may create some ambiguity, but unfortunately that's the nature of the world that we all have to operate in, is that we don't always have a clear black and white answer. So where there are disagreements between how one consultant may view an issue versus another, it doesn't mean one's right or one's wrong necessarily. It may be their interpretation. You as an audience, listen to what they say and what seems to make sense. Hopefully there is not a whole lot of different disagreement at the time, but it's not unusual or uncommon for there to be disagreement.
We'll take the next call or the next question that was submitted. My question is regarding an MSP, Medicare Secondary. As a provider-based RHC, are we to file our MSP claims through our Part A intermediary or to Part B? Should we be filing these electronically or by paper? I think this is an add-on to the discussion we had on the first question, but who'd like to jump in on this one? Anybody? I'll start picking people.
Well, this is Jeff. Jeff Johnson, and I would agree that this is kind of the initial question, but essentially that if they cross it over, great. If they don't, then you have to drop a claim on a 1500 type form.
Okay.
So.
All right. Why don't we take another one from the call-in or from the pre-submitted? Would a nursing home resident this is actually similar to the discussion we just had, but would a nursing home resident have to have been a patient of the RHC prior to being admitted to the nursing home to be considered an RHC visit? And I don't know that we specifically got into that aspect of it. I think it was discussion they have to be an RHC patient, but that relationship, can that be established post-nursing home admission, or is that something that would have to have been established prior to the individual being in the nursing home?
This is Jim Estes again. I'll come back to my answer that I gave previously. I don't see anywhere in the rules where it says they have to be physically present in the rural health clinic to be established as a patient. And one of the rationales behind that I used is many, many times, and in your own case, maybe your relatives face this. They are in the hospital, and then they go to a skilled bed, for a certain number of days. They don't progress as well as they thought they would, so they end up going to long-term care, and then they're there until they pass on. They're never physically able to even leave a care setting to come to the clinic. So it's ludicrous to say they're required to actually be wheeled into the clinic so they're physically present. One of the three locations you can provide services are the patient's place of residence, the nursing facility, or in the rural health clinic. So having services provided in any of those locations, as long as you have the documentation in the chart that's retained in the clinic, would establish you as a patient of the rural health clinic.
Okay. I would agree. This is Jeff. I would agree with that. And also, I just want to make sure that everyone's very clear that a swing bed is considered a skilled nursing facility care and is also a rural health clinic visit. So for you critical access hospitals out there, make sure that you're billing that as such.
Just to clarify on that, when you refer to a swing bed, I suspect most people, but a swing bed can either be a hospital inpatient bed or a nursing home bed. What you're referring to is when that bed is classified as a nursing home bed, not an acute inpatient bed.
Correct. That would be a transitional care bed or a skilled nursing bed in a that may be the physically same, you know, really actually the physical same bed as the hospital bed.
Right.
But it's actually from an admission standpoint, they're actually discharged as an inpatient and then admitted as a swing bed patient.
Right. Right. Okay. Just further clarification. All right. Operator, we'll take our next call. Call in.
As a reminder, that is star one if you have a question, and please state your name and city and state location before posing your question. We'll take our next caller. Please go ahead.
Hi. My name is Mary Peterson, calling from the Mile Bluff Clinic in Wauston, Wisconsin. And I have a question regarding the Medicaid stimulus. We have been talking with our state of Wisconsin and our medical society, and they cautioned us that the Medicaid stimulus is only for Medicaid Title 19 patients, and in questioning further, they said it would not be for Title 21 patients, which in the state of Wisconsin we believe is the Well Women's Program. So I guess in reading, I have not ever seen anything differentiated that it would not be all of our Medicaid patients, no matter what title they may be under.
I'm not aware of anything from the federal government that suggests that there would be a differentiation between a type of a Medicaid patient. If an individual is classified as a Medicaid patient, whether it be the differentiation you've made, but they're classified as a Medicaid patient, that they would be counted for purposes of meeting your 30% threshold.
Well, this just came up today.
I'm sorry?
This just came up today, and, you know, when we look up eligibility, you don't even see what title they may be under. You just
right.
see eligible, yes or no.
Yes.
Mary?
Stay for some documentation on that.
Hey, Mary, this is Jeff. Just a quick thing. That's not uncommon for several states to have some kind of a state program that sometimes gets confused as a Medicaid patient when it truly isn't. So that's just something specific that you're going to have to address with the state of Wisconsin.
So, Jeff, are you saying that these patients that Mary identified are not Medicaid patients?
They may not be construed as Medicaid patients for purposes of counting, you know, to meet the 30%, I think it is, threshold or whatever.
Why are they not a Medicaid? They're either a Medicaid patient or they're not.
Like they have Medicaid limited benefits.
Well, this is Ron. Part of the problem, and having had experience, particularly in that state, is that the state does have some latitude in interpretation of those programs, and unless the statute is specific, what we see is the states will say, okay, it's only Title 19 because the statute doesn't say specifically, you know, and so the question will be whether CMS says, no, it is all Medicaid, Title 19 and 21, or CMS says, well, it's not clear in the legislation, so it's up to the state, and their state plan is what governs how they apply this. That's generally been the response that we get from the state level.
Well, we'll look into that, Mary, and we'll try and get an answer, and when we get an answer, we'll post it on the listserv.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay. We'll take another question from the phone lines, operator.
Caller, your line is open. Please go ahead. Caller, your line is open to ask a question. Please unmute your phone.
There you go. Hi, this is Linda in Sioux City, Iowa. And I'm not sure if anybody else has had a problem, but we've had a problem with patients' Medicare secondary payer records getting updated on the common working file. And just wondering if anybody has a solution as far as getting updates made. When we've called, they've not been able to take our information, and they indicate that the patient or a person who is responsible for the patient has to call with the information. And sometimes that's just not possible. Anybody have any ideas on how to resolve that?
From our experience, this is Charles again, it is indeed the patient or the patient's representative that's got to do that, unless anyone has any differing guidance.
Okay. Yeah, I've even had to had the patient contact their state representative because they've called and not been able to get it updated. And finally, when the state representative calls, things happen. But
yeah.
Just wondering if there's an easier workaround, because it is confusing and hard to get in for the patient to speak to someone who can explain things to them.
I feel your pain.
Ditto.
All right. Well, thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Linda. All right. This was a pre-submitted question. If a patient is a Medicare or Medicaid patient, the patient has a 90-day global surgery. Then it's seen back in the Rural Health Clinic for post-op, which the surgeon is in the RHC clinic who performed the surgery, but is having post-op seroma or infection or just a suture removal. Can the visit be billed as at an encounter rate, or is it billed as a 99024 post-op, or should a modifier always be put on the procedure code? I've had people say to put the modifier on, then all RHC encounters are billed out. But if you don't use the modifier, then you have to follow global rules. What's the correct way to bill this? This comes from Creta Corrigan, and she says, I always thought that any face-to-face visit in RHC by the physician is always billed out as an encounter rate. Please help me with this issue. This issue of the global billing and surgery and RHCs is one that comes up fairly frequently. Who wants to jump in?
This is Ron. I'd like to comment because we have a CMS official who did comment on the listserv about this very specific issue about 2 months ago. And she clarified that the surgeon has to correctly code for what they are doing. If the surgeon knows and is employed in the Rural Health Clinic that they will be doing the follow-up visits in the Rural Health Clinic, they should be coding for the surgery only, and then the visits are in fact coded based on the RHC face-to-face encounter. And I think that's has been clarified. It still doesn't take away the confusion people have between CPT and RHC policy. But irregardless of whether the patient has a seroma, which is a complication of surgery, or it's routine follow-up, those visits in the RHC should be billed as RHC visits. But the surgery should have been billed with the modifier code for surgery only. Now, that doesn't take into account if the surgeon, did provide the care, the surgical care in the hospital, and then subsequently patient has the complications and goes to an RHC that's unrelated, then those visits are also billed as RHC visits and not affected by the global CPT rules.
So there's Charles, let me just, before you go, and I'll give you so the two questions, if I heard it correctly, one is, how did the original surgeon bill for the surgery? Was it billed surgery only or global? Because when they bill global, the expectation is there's a certain amount of post-operative care that has been paid to that surgeon through that global fee, and to pay for the RHC, if that physician is affiliated with the RHC, would essentially constitute double payment.
Exactly.
And the other issue is whether or not that surgeon is affiliated with the RHC or not. If they're not affiliated with the RHC, then the RHC doing post-operative care would not be held to would receive payment regardless of whether or not the surgeon billed globally or not, because they're not affiliated with that surgeon. whereas if the RHC is affiliated with the surgeon and they've billed it global, there would be no post-operative visits allowed as RHC encounters because they've already been paid for that.
That's my interpretation and what we've received from CMS.
Charles, you wanted to add on that?
The only thing I was going to add is that I think what I found problematic in the question was the blanket statement that qualified provider sees the patient in the RHC, it's an RHC visit. You know, that's certainly in general terms correct, but it has to be medically necessary, as we've talked about a lot, and it has to warrant the skills of that provider.
Right.
So, a suture removal, if there's no other exacerbating problems, does not really warrant the skills of the provider frequently.
So even if it's done by a physician, it's not classified as a face-to-face encounter because it's not medically necessary for the physician to remove those sutures and therefore does not meet the test of an encounter.
You know, in the days of Riverbend, they would say, they specifically excluded in their LCD suture removal as not medically necessary. And their response always seemed to be, if there's a particular reason that patient needed the skills of the doc, it was a particularly bad wound, it got infected, et cetera, then make sure it's documented.
Okay. All right. Well, great. Thanks. We'll take a question from the callers.
Caller, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yes, this is Janie Elliott again, and I think we need to revisit the question about MSPs. Because it's two different issues. The first issue that we talked about was Medicare secondary payments. Do Medicare paid primary, then we had to get our secondary payment, our patient's copay, our coinsurance or deductible. MSPs are when Medicare is primary. Medicare is secondary. So we've billed a commercial insurance as primary. Now we have to get our coinsurance copay to Medicare. That is a totally different issue, and I think that question was asking about MSPs, and I specifically have talked to WPS, and they say that they do not pay a Medicare secondary payer claim as a Rural Health Clinic encounter.
They're going to pick up whatever the coinsurance is.
That's correct, and that's it. And they will not accept it anyway but electronically. You have to get it to them electronically first.
Which also excludes DDE. You can't do it on DDE anymore.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
But I think we just needed to make that clear because I'm pretty sure that's where the question came from.
Which takes it back to your practice management system.
Right.
And making sure I'm going to make an assumption that people are submitting ANSI claims in a 5010 format for their UBs, the ANSI institutional. And that whatever the practice management system is needs to be able to populate the correct fields for the condition codes, et cetera, to pass that MSP claim, and then obviously the clearinghouse takes it too. So there are a number of places that claim can easily fall off, beginning with the practice management system.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, Janie, for pointing out the distinction and getting that clarification. We'll take another call from the callers. Operator?
Caller, please go ahead. Caller, your line is open. Please go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yep. Speak up just a little bit, but we can hear you.
Okay, this is Michelle from Lake City. I have two or three questions, so do you want me just to ask one and then go back in the queue, or?
No, you can go ahead if they're not too long. Where is Lake City?
In Florida.
Okay,
first question. If we're an RHC clinic, and if we see the child here, then we admit them on the same day. We can't bill and get paid for it. Is there some way around that, or is that just the way it is? Second question is concerning the wraparound payments, because we're still not receiving any of those, and I'm wondering if there's something we need. Okay, third.
Hold on,
the third question is the stimulus package for going to EMR. Has anyone actually received any money from that program yet? Because we're wanting to do that, but we're wanting to see that they're actually paying out also.
Who wants to take, I wanted to try and break them down because I think we're going to forget. With the first question, go back, ask your first question again.
Okay, if we see the child here at the RHC clinic and we admit them to the hospital, when we bill for that, if they're admitted the same day, we do not get paid for it. Is there something we can do so that we actually get billed or we can get paid for seeing them in the, here at the clinic?
And I'm going to assume that as a child, it's probably Medicaid. We're not dealing with a disabled child that's covered by Medicare.
It is Medicaid, yes.
Okay. Anybody want to take a crack at a Florida Medicaid?
Only the Florida Medicaid does whatever Florida Medicaid wants to.
Yep.
They tend to be non-compliant in terms of the RHC program. And I think there's adequate argument been made previously by the largest previous FI of the Rahoff Clinics program, and there's adequate argument even in some appeals documents that I've recently reviewed that if there's documentation of a service being provided in a rural health clinic and service being provided at a Part B facility like in the hospital, that even as Medicaid, they are required to pay two visits. However, CMS tends to defer to whatever the state put in their plan. If they say in their plan that they were only going to pay for one visit, until we get some additional interpretation on this issue, which we've asked from CMS, I think you're probably at the mercy of the Florida Medicaid program with us, and we'll only get paid one visit.
Okay. All right. Michelle, your second question? Did we lose Michelle?
Yes, can you hear me?
Wraparound
payment.
Yeah,
we can hear you now.
Yeah, the wraparound payments, we're still not receiving those, and they keep saying they broke it down into a project for 2009 and then 2010. Anybody heard anything, receiving any of these payments, know what's going on?
Are you talking about wraparounds from your Medicaid managed care to your rate?
Yes.
What wraparound payment do you mean?
Yeah, the Medicaid wraparound on their 2 years. So you have a Medicaid managed care contract, and the amount that you're being paid under that contract is less than what you would have gotten under your RHC all-inclusive rate or PPS rate.
Right.
And the state has not paid you your quarterly wraparound payments to make you whole.
Right.
And is that unique to you, or is that all providers in Florida? And have other? I don't know if any of you of our consultants work with clinics in Florida. Is that a universal problem in Florida, or is that something that may be unique to their clinic?
Getting correct payments for rural health in Florida is problematic across the spectrum.
Okay.
I agree with them. And the problem is that Florida pays on a fixed rate to most clinics, and so then when the managed care Medicaid started to come back into Florida, it raised huge issues for reconciling, as Charles pointed out. It's just problematic, and Florida tends to pretty much ignore and do what Florida wants to do.
Okay. If you would send me an email at info@narhc.org, we can make some inquiries up to CMS, see if they're aware that Florida may not be compliant. Clearly, they're required to make those payments if they're not, and see if we can't. We don't want to be overly optimistic, but we can at least see if we can get CMS to try and force the state to be compliant.
And you're Jeff.
Glenn, you wanted to add something?
This is Jeff Johnson.
I'm sorry.
Just from a matter of perspective, that's not uncommon in several other states, and in fact, in the state of Minnesota, which is where I reside, one of the avenues they took is the rural health clinics partnered with the FQHCs, which tend to have, for one reason or another, a larger lobbying, or at least have a little more somewhere along the way, at least in the state of Minnesota, a little weight because of the urban presence, and they have the same issue. So it might be just a lawsuit type of thing where you need to just kind of address it from that perspective.
And then, Michelle, your last question had to do, I believe, with incentive payments.
All right, but question, what's your name?
This is Bill.
Bill, and you're the one who sent me the email address for info@narhc.org, right?
info@narhc.org, correct.
All right, see. Okay. Just want to make sure. Okay, yes, the last was about the EMR, and had anyone actually received payments from that as an incentive?
No, there's two components. States are authorized to begin making payments in 2010 for the adoption, implementation, or upgrading of an EHR. That was on a voluntary basis. The actual meaningful use incentive payments don't begin until 2011, and cash from that won't begin to flow until later in the year. Providers will have to demonstrate their meaningful use of the electronic health record that they have, and they will have to meet those objectives and measures within those objectives. And it will take, they're going to have to take 90 to 120 days to be able to demonstrate that they can meet those meaningful, to provide the data to justify meaningful use. So we won't see any incentive money for EHR flowing until later the second half or fourth quarter of 2011.
Okay.
And keep in mind that is, you know, for us as rural health clinics, the federal incentive is based on Medicare fee-for-service payments. So we're all going to be firmly in the state Medicaid incentive plan to get anything out of it.
Right.
Okay. So we'll be state level, not federal.
Right. But the states will administer the program, but just the money for the Medicaid incentive is a direct pass-through from the federal government. So it is not something that should be that the state should be able to either siphon off or prohibit clinics who meet the criteria from receiving those. It's not a state budgetary issue, since that money is a direct pass-through from the federal government.
Okay, are there any exceptions relating to pediatric clinics, or is it just clinics as a whole?
Well, the only exception with the pediatrics is some of the threshold levels. You can get a reduced payment, a lower threshold on a 20% threshold as opposed to a 30% threshold, and then you only get two-thirds of the financial incentive that's available for pediatricians. But other than that, they're held to the same standard as everybody else.
Okay.
All right, we'll take I'll take another pre-submitted question. I have an OBGYN physician in one of my clinics, and she'll do procedures in the office, colonoscopies or removal of IUDs, and this is also a Florida Medicaid, some things that are billable, but what about Medicare? How do we get paid for some things with them, or is some of this in the cost reporting? Anyone?
This is Ron. OBGYN physicians' practices can be established as rural health clinics because they're considered also part of primary care. The problem is that they tend to do some procedures in their office, as pointed out in the question, that can be more expensive and, in fact, tend to be difficult to bill and get paid for. In some of the states, they allow for a separate billing fee-for-service for those larger procedures that might include things like family planning with double Provera injections, colposcopies, IUD insertions, and they cover them separately under, also in some cases, under a women's health program, such as referred to, I think, as Title 21 in Wisconsin. The problem is if it's an independent rural health clinic, you have to weigh the rate, the cap rate that you have for your Medicaid services against the cost of doing these services that are going to be in your costs. If your costs far exceed the cap, you may want to reevaluate doing those services on Medicaid patients in your office. If there's a proximity to an outpatient hospital facility, one might try and do some of those within the hospital facility to help reduce, you know, some of the cost and the potential loss on the Medicaid side.
Okay. We'll take another caller, operator.
Caller, your line is open. Please go ahead. Caller, we're unable to hear you. If you're on mute, please
Hello.
Hey, caller.
Hi, this is Shannon again from Wayne Medical Center, Piedmont, Missouri. I want to open back up the MSP because I heard a question arise that I need clarification on. One of the responses was that Medicare and Medicaid secondary claims should be billed to WPS, in the state of Missouri anyway, on the Medicare side, not to Cahaba. am I understanding that response correctly? Because I was under the impression if it was in the rural health clinic, even though it was secondary Medicare, it's still part of the RHC contract.
I think that, this is Charles again, I think the confusion was is that, and Janie can correct me if I'm wrong, I think Janie is provider-based, and they as a provider-based RWPS is their intermediary.
Okay.
So they're provider-based rural health clinic, and they use WPS for their fee-for-service as well as their rural health clinic claims.
So
you being Cahaba, if it's a Medicare as secondary payer, that MSP, after the commercial's paid, is going to go to Cahaba.
Thank you for that clarification.
Yeah.
All right. We'll take another caller. Operator?
Caller, please go ahead.
Yes, this is Betsy from Bushnell, Florida, and my question is, is there a possibility with a physician that does minor surgery in a rural area to carve out part of the time of the rural health clinic when there's no other patients there to do minor surgery?
That would occur within the building that is identified as a rural health clinic?
The building is a rural health clinic. Correct.
Okay, and you want to know if you can take a room and carve it out of the RHC cost report and provide procedures or surgery and bill those to Part B?
Correct, and just only because there's nobody in the area that does these minor, you know, lesion removals, those kinds of things.
This is Charles. I'm sorry if I'm talking too much. Somebody tell me to shut up. I just gave when you put it on those terms that because there are no other providers in the area, I think you have a solid basis to establish some non-rural health clinic hours and do that. I just gave a presentation down in Texas, and there was a guy from Trailblazers there who is – there, you know, he keeps an ear to the ground, and he used the word to me, this financial triage, that when you're doing things because you get paid better under one scenario, that CMS is going to start looking at that stuff. So when your reasoning is that, you know, if there's nobody else in the area, I think you're on firm footing. So maybe I'll let somebody else speak to taking just a room and carving that out.
Yeah, this is Jeff Johnson from Wifley, and I guess there is no prohibition of establishing a specialty clinic within a rural health clinic as long as you can identify separately those costs, and in your case, set up a hours of operation, say, if you're open 8 to 5 typically, and you want to establish this 2 or 3 days a week from 1 to 5 or something like that. As long as that is not fluctuating and, as Charles put it, triaging those patients for financial reward, you will have no problem with an intermediary, a cost report reviewer or auditor in establishing that. In fact, what we have typically done is once we've established kind of what we want to do with this type of service line, if you will, we often identify exactly in a letter to the intermediary, here's what we're going to do. Here's the cost, and there's no cost, you know, shifting from rural health clinic to surgery or whatever just because of the reimbursement differences and so forth. And this is typically for independents more than provider-based rural health clinics. That has not been a problem at all, and typically they will sign off on that.
And your name is?
Jeff Johnson from Wifley.
But it has to be the whole clinic, right, Jeff?
No, it does not have to be the whole clinic.
Okay.
It can be a, as Bill kind of precluded or prefaced, it can be an area of the clinic that we identify as a, that you may identify as a specialty clinic. Okay. And in fact, I would go that route more so, Charles, than just banking on the fact that you're the only caregiver in the area that does that service.
The other thing, though, that is important is you need to post that, and it needs to be part of your posted hours, saying
right.
That you have a specialty. For example, in my practice, that's exactly what we do. 8 to 10 every Thursday morning is for procedures, and that's non-RHC time, and it's posted. And that's important to also to post those hours. But I agree also with Jeff and Charles. It's certainly a methodology that can be done. It's just that you need to make sure you have a good methodology that you can defend and demonstrate to your auditors.
And well documented.
Yes.
It also is not just the space, but the staff. How much of your staff time, you know, what is your administrative support staff obligation or work with regard to that specialty space or the specialty clinic? If you captured 100% of your staff time on your RHC cost report, but yet those staff are responsible for doing administrative work for what's going on in that specialty clinic, then you would run into a problem there because you're essentially going to be double paid, or you're double booking that administration. So it's not enough to just look at the physical space, but look at all the other costs that may also have to be carved out in association with what's going on in that space. Is that correct?
That is correct, Bill. That is correct.
Okay, this is Jim. I'm a little bit confused, so I'm going to pose a question to the other guys. I thought that on the cost report, when it asked for non-RHC hours of operations on page 2, where you define when you're an RHC and when you're not, it is talking about the entire facility, not just one room, because then that affects the overall cost. You're reducing all of your overhead and administrative costs in the middle section by whatever percentage of overall time you're not a rural health clinic. Otherwise, you're talking about a doctor walking out of one room where he's doing specialty work and then walking across the hall to his regular rural health clinic during hours of operation. I mean, we don't have a distinction between rural health hours and non-rural health hours for the whole building, just a room. Because that's what I heard, was that you could have just one room that was non-rural health during certain hours.
Jim, this is Ron. I believe that it has to do with the methodology, and I do believe you have to post the hours that you, in fact, are operating, as Jeff has referred to, a specialty clinic, or you're doing surgical procedures, that's non-RHC time. The issue of total facility and saying it's the total facility really is the methodology you need to determine to say, okay, it's, for example, in my office there's a surgical procedure room, and we have developed a methodology to say what the costs are associated with the operation of that surgical procedure room from the hours of 8 to 10 on Thursday, which makes it non-RHC during that time, and those costs are appropriately all carved out of the RHC cost center. And it gets down to having an appropriate methodology. Unfortunately, many clinics don't have the ability to have that kind of process in place to keep track of carving those out, and there's a tendency for people to do what you say. Well, I'll do a procedure, but geez, now another patient walked in, I'll go see them. And that is not allowed. I absolutely agree, that is not allowed. But I think, you know, in my case, for example, in my clinic, 8 to 10, all I do is procedures. So I'm not walking in and seeing other RHC patients. It's a procedure day. It's non-RHC day, and that all of those costs are accounted for relative to the room and the staff and what I do relative to 8 to 10 on Thursdays. And I think
the commingling issue is covered by that kind of methodology. I think the client also, the clinic needs to look and compare their reimbursements. If we're talking lumps and bumps and minor things, are you really going to get that much more by having it Part B when you compare how much your cost may be reduced by having to take that off of your cost report? You know, if you're just barely at the cap as a freestanding clinic, you might not want to do that because it may drop you below that maximum reimbursement level once you make those carve-offs. Are you going to recover the difference from the more that you get from billing those to Part B? Plus, how much of your business is Medicare? Because you can't just say Medicare patients have to come in Tuesdays from 8 to 10. It's got to be everybody.
And I think that's the point, is you need to do the analysis to see if it's truly advantageous.
There you go.
And set it up very gingerly. I think just the level of detail we just covered right here shows, you know, it's something to be careful with.
It's something that you can do, but you have to do it correctly. And if you don't do it correctly, you can get crosswise with the auditors. And so make sure you get good advice and you do it correctly, I think, is what the takeaway message. It's permissible, but it's only permissible if done correctly.
You don't want to be answering for that when you're sitting across the desk from the wrong person.
Right. We'll take another caller, operator. And how many calls do we have in the queue?
We have 3 currently in the queue.
Okay. don't we, we'll just go to all the callers, and if we still have some time, we'll try and get to some of the written questions. So go to the callers.
Caller, your line is open. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Wendy with Mount Union Medical in Mount Union, Pennsylvania. We're an RHC. And I have a curiosity to see if any of the other RHCs receive any notification of CMS rate changes in a timely manner ever. An example is that we find that we are being reimbursed above the capitated rate that is allowable by CMS for our cost reports. So from year to year, we either have a credit of a significant amount of money or we have an unexpected payment of significant money. So I'm just trying to find out if there's a way to be notified of those changes prior to the end of fiscal year and a final cost report.
You must be, this is Jeff, I'll take that one. You must be a provider-based to a probably a PPS or a critical access hospital.
Correct. We're an outpatient rural health clinic, and we bill an entity.
Right. So you're a provider-based rural health clinic, and the fact that you are is why you have those fluctuations, because a lot of the independent rural health clinics are capped at the, you know, for this year, I think it's $76.84. But as a provider-based rural health clinic attached to a hospital with less than 50 beds, there is no limit. Okay, so you are unlimited in your cost per encounter. And so, but obviously that cost per encounter will fluctuate based on productivity and cost 1 year to the next. In order to avoid that is for you to talk with your CFO of the hospital and make sure that they are doing interim cost reports at least on a quarterly basis, and you can submit those to the intermediary to get that rate changed proactively versus waiting till the end. Because obviously you want to, if you're being underpaid, your cost per encounter have gone up and you're being underpaid, you want to get that cash now.
That's the issue. It's very difficult to project the outcome, and when you're looking at a nonprofit and having a slim budget to begin with, you know, I mean, it can make or break you, honestly. And we are not affiliated with the hospital. We are independent. So I am the administrator, and even my accounts come to me, and they don't know what we should do. But you're suggesting a quarterly interim cost report. Is that correct?
Correct, with the intermediary, yep.
Yeah, if you were operating under the assumption that she was a provider-based RHC with a hospital fewer than 50 beds, what I think I just heard her say is no, she's an independent RHC. Does that change anything?
Well, the only thing that would change is if your costs are so low that you're less than the limit. That would be the only thing that would make that change if you're independent. Now, I thought you said you were provider-based to a hospital.
No, we are an outpatient rural health clinic, and we bill as an entity with one physician and two mid-levels. We are independent. We are community-owned and operated.
Okay.
So the issue is more that what your actual experience is significantly different from 1 year to the next, and so your projected cost report is substantially different than your actual cost report, resulting in a significant either overpayment or underpayment when you get to the end of the year.
Absolutely,
so,
and we've tried everything to try to get some direction from every, you know, governing agency we can think of, and we just get the same answer. This is our protocol. This is how we do it. And it's
who's your intermediary?
Highmark.
Yeah, it should be Highmark.
Okay.
I mean, I would think that, and you guys know this stuff better than I do, but one is having an internal mechanism where they can better monitor and track their costs and their productivity to determine whether or not they're having, you know, seeing far fewer patients, seeing far more patients, which is going to cause an adjustment to their average cost per visit, or if there's some significant fluctuation in their costs, the costs that they incurred in 1 year and not previous years, or in previous years and not this year. But
let me just interject saying that, honestly, from year to year, our encounters are relatively similar. So our business component, as far as that goes, we're not changing. Like, our bottom line does not fluctuate that much. The number of patients that we see does not fluctuate that much. It's just we're getting, here's a perfect example. Last year, we got a $9,800 credit. This year, I owe $22,000.
due within, like, 2 weeks.
Well, if, guys, you want to address that?
Well,
I
go ahead. If your encounters aren't changing from year to year and your cost is not changing from year to year, there's something weird going on there. I just don't, unless there's a bonus that maybe is that, you know, if there's some kind of compensation adjustment at the year end that's not being picked up because the cost report has to be made on the accrual basis, or prepared on the accrual basis, and maybe you're filing it as cash basis, so something 1 year it's
We are a cash basis operation.
Yeah, so that would be the only thing that could potentially be doing that is if, you know, I can't imagine anything else.
Charles, I just think you
make
this
sure that you have someone preparing cost reports also that understands, you know, the REC program, because as Jeff points out, something doesn't make sense if you're stable in terms of current dollar volume and visits, then there shouldn't be any major fluctuations, and it doesn't make sense unless there's somehow that in your cost report preparation something's happening.
I would suggest getting the last 3 years of the cost report and contact one of the people on this call and have them take a look at them.
Absolutely.
Would there be anyone in particular?
Anybody on this call would be able to help you.
If you can send that to me electronically, what I can do is forward it on to all the folks on the call and others, and anyone who wants to take a look at it and get back to you, we'll do it that way. Okay?
Are you Bill?
Yes, at info@narhc.org. Whatever you can send me electronically, I will forward on, and folks can take a look at it.
I have a disk. Would I be able to send that regular mail to you? Would that work?
I don't know. I'm not an electronic guru. We'll try and send me an email with your phone number. I'll call you, and we'll try and figure something out.
That would be awesome. The other issue I wanted to raise real quickly is we just received notification from about 5 years ago for our clinic that we are entitled to clearly about $30,000 that we had never received.
Walk, run, don't walk.
Yeah, it makes no sense. Understand, none. For Medicaid.
For Medicaid?
Yes.
Oh, Medicaid, I wouldn't spend it anytime soon. You can put it in the bank and let it sit there.
Next year
they may send you a bill.
Well, it's kind of related to the Florida question and some of the other examples I have brought or that have been brought up. The states are often way behind on settling the difference between your Medicaid fee schedule, if you get paid that way, which every state is different, or the managed care and the actual PPS rate they established back in 2001.
7 years is quite some time to try to...
Sounds like everybody's invited to Mount Union for a barbecue.
Okay, bring the food.
All right, thank you. We'll go on to our next caller. Next question from a caller.
Caller, please go ahead.
Hi, this is Michelle from Lake City again. I have a question concerning, we have a satellite clinic, and we would like to change the location, move it from one building to another, but we've got some conflicting comments on that. Does it change the rate we would be able to collect, and do we have to reapply for everything as a rural health clinic again, just simply moving them from, like, down the road, like 2 or 3 miles?
You just have to do it.
Go ahead.
No, pardon me. You go, Jim.
This is Jim Estes. When you said satellite clinic, that always raises the little hair on the back of my neck. You mean another facility that's affiliated with your organization, it's under your umbrella, that has its own provider number with the rural health clinic?
Yes.
It's
a second office that we have. It's a little bit further. And it has its own rural health
clinic
designation.
Okay. All right. Good.
But you want to move that physical facility from its current location to a location that is 2 to 3 miles away. Is that what you're asking?
Yes, that's what I'm asking.
In my experience, that requires a change of information with Medicare and with Medicaid. It can trigger a new inspection. Depends on your state. Doesn't always, but I don't think you're talking about closing the clinic and reopening as far as refiling 855A application and going through all that nightmare process again. But you do definitely have to file the change of information. Make sure your new address is still in a health professional shortage area and is still rural so that it's still qualified. If
okay.
your zip code is changing, that could make a difference.
Okay, but as long as the zip code's not changing, we shouldn't have to reapply for everything and it shouldn't change everything, correct?
That's my understanding. What do you guys think?
Surveyors. It's a judgment call on their part as to how they want to handle it.
That's what I'm afraid of, Florida.
Well, as far as Medicare is concerned,
you're moving 2 to 3 miles away as opposed to across the street. You're entering into an area, a gray area, where the state may come back and say, no, this is a very significant change in location. We want to reevaluate it, make sure that the area qualifies. We want to inspect a physical plant and conduct a new inspection because it's a significant change in location. Others may take a less stringent view of things.
Well, actually, it's less than a mile down the road. So do you think that would trigger?
It's hard to say with the state. The Medicare, all you're needing to look at is filing the change of information with your address changes and so forth for that provider number. As far as what the state's going to do for an inspection, I'd check with your state inspector and tell them, here's what we're doing.
Make sure you're accurate. I mean, you went from moving down the road to 2 to 3 miles to back to less than a mile. And I don't know what it is, but, you know, whatever you describe it, if you come back subsequently and change and say, well, it's actually this, I think you create the impression that maybe you were trying to get away with something. So, you know, if it's a mile, it's a mile. If it's 2 blocks, it's 2 blocks. If it's 3 miles, it's 3 miles. However you describe the move, make sure that you describe it accurately and completely the first time.
Okay. Sounds good.
Okay. Next caller. Do we have any more callers?
Hi. This is Carol from the Mild Love Clinic in Mauston, Wisconsin.
Hey, Carol.
Hi. Just following up on some questions regarding the stimulus criteria. As I understand it, am I correct in saying that RHC providers do not qualify for the Medicare stimulus because we don't bill to the intermediary Part B, we bill to Part A, so that when we do any reporting, is that correct?
It's not that you don't.
There's a couple of words there. It's not that you don't qualify. Every physician who potentially qualifies,
right.
The amount of the incentive payment that a physician can get from Medicare is a percentage of what they submit based on the fee schedule. There are physicians working in RHCs who submit rural health clinic claims, but who also submit claims on the fee based on the fee schedule. So
correct. I understand.
Okay. Well, but you said qualified, and that's
right. Yeah, and I apologize for that. Then the second thing is then the Part B, when they submit their hospital bills, that does not qualify that is not eligible for stimulus dollars because it's the site of service is the hospital?
That I don't believe that's correct. Why would that not qualify as a claim from that physician or be disqualified or discounted as a claim for purposes of calculating the amount of money you'd receive under a stimulus?
Okay, that's good. So then they can. Okay, then my last question is, for meeting the Medicaid stimulus 30% threshold, can you qualify? Can you be qualified for an entire clinic? So you could include the PAs that are not eligible professionals in that, or do you have to meet the threshold per individual?
You can do it either way. You can do it as an individual, or you can do it as a facility, so that if 30% of the facility's patients' visits were with Medicaid patients, but let's say you're not a PA-led clinic, and so you're only qualifying for a physician, you can still qualify based on the aggregate, or you can qualify based on the individual numbers.
Including the PA?
It would be calculated in the aggregate for the entire, whoever is billing under that that aggregate number, the NPI for the organization. So all of those PA claims would be calculable for meeting the aggregate number, even though individually you might not be a PA-led clinic. Now, I would say that there's some flexibility in there in terms of being a PA-led clinic. If you'll recall, one of it is if the PA is a clinical director, designated as a clinical director for the facility, then the clinic, then that would be classified as a PA-led clinic, and you would be, your PAs would be eligible. I don't see any reason why, as your RHC, you could not designate your PAs as clinic directors.
Because there's a physician there, that is?
Well, the physician is the medical director.
Yeah. Right.
There were two different, if you recall in the rule, there were two different classifications. One is a medical director, the other is a clinical director. And it says if the PA is the medical director or the clinical director, the facility can qualify as a PA-led clinic. So your physician is your medical director, you classify your PA as a clinical director, and therefore can qualify as a PA-led clinic.
If you do that, then can all of your PAs be eligible for Medicaid dollars, or is it just the one?
I don't have the language in front of me, but I don't believe it made a distinction in terms of the numbers. I think it said if you have a PA clinical director, the facility is classified as a PA-led clinic, and therefore what it says is in the statute, physician assistants are eligible to the extent that they are working in a PA-led clinic.
Okay. Makes sense. Okay, thank you.
We had two more queue up.
Okay, we'll take those.
Caller, please go ahead. Caller, your line's open.
In medical again, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Other than grants that are independently being offered, is the NARHC able or looking at collaboration for multiple RHC sites for in numbers, like volume of numbers, for applying or utilizing independent RHC, I don't know how I want to word this, but for grant money toward purchasing an EMR, is there any affiliation out there for collaboration in an attempt to seek funding for the purchase of an EMR?
I guess the immediate answer is no, but because we have not engaged any of the vendors or done anything of that nature. Is what you're asking, however, is there some opportunity for some type of a group purchasing arrangement that might allow for a lower cost product to be available because it would be made available and at a bulk price rather than individual RHCs purchasing them at a unit level?
Yes. For instance, I'm not sure how many, but we use a centricity scheduling system and billing system through virtual office, and I have quotes out there, you know, from different vendors. But it's, at this point still, even though the cost has come down somewhat, it's still almost cost prohibitive just for us independently to purchase that to get in guideline, you know, for the regulations that are coming forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know other than
the grant. To answer your question, no, we've not, and that's something maybe we can take a look at and see if there's some way to try and get lower cost products available or, you know, see what might be available. But at this time, no, there's nothing in the works.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Next caller.
Caller, your line is open. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Lisa Odom with the Sisters of Mercy Health System in Missouri, and just wanted to clarify when we were talking about the specialty clinic, if you were saying that the specialty services have to be during non-RHC time, that they could not be during the RHC time, were you making that distinct separation?
I didn't quite understand the question.
I think it was on the carving out of space for providing specialty care services that you would bill as non-RHC. Did that have to be during non-RHC hours, or could it occur during RHC hours? I think that's what your question was.
Right, that's exactly right.
I think that two of us were saying it could occur during RHC hours, and two of us were saying that the whole... that it had been our understanding that the whole clinic needed to be. So I think where the discussion ended was to say, at least, and I don't want to put words in Ron and Jeff's mouth, but so I understand what they said, you can establish a space in the clinic that is non-RHC, but it has distinctly identifiable costs, you've got a methodology for identifying those costs, and that you've posted the hours that space is non-RHC. So a lot of it came down to how well you documented and identified the costs and posted the hours associated with that non-RHC space.
That's more or less correct, Charles.
Now, this is Jim again. I'm just, you know, that whole concept makes me very uncomfortable just because
likewise.
The whole commingling thing and the fact that if you mark that you've got non-RHC hours, which you would have to do on the second page of the cost report, I've been told by numerous auditors that that's automatically a cause for them to look a little closer to make sure that you're doing it right and that you are making the correct adjustments or reclassifications. So it's just one of those things where you really better be able to make more money significantly or that it increases access to care or broadens your scope of practice enough to where you're really meeting community needs in order to really justify doing that. Also, keep in mind that if you're talking about having the room, and like Ron was saying, that's all he does on those days is procedures. You better have enough of those to keep your provider busy during the time that you set that up, because technically they're not supposed to go across the hall and provide other services. They're on the clock of the non-RHC area during those times. So the same is true if you set hours of operation for the whole clinic. What happens to your walk-in patients when you come in? I know of a lot of clinics that don't even have a regular Medicaid provider number anymore. When they become a rural health clinic, that entity loses its Medicaid number in that particular state. How would you bill for those services that you did with walk-ins? Would you turn them away? A lot of issues that before anyone goes down that path, they really need to do, as Ron was saying, the analysis from a cost and a practicality and an increase of access to care, change of scope of practice. All these things need to be considered. It's not something you just go off half-cocked and do.
Thank you.
Okay.
Sure.
Are there any other calls in the queue, operator?
None at this time.
Okay. Because we're actually going over and we've prevailed, there were some questions that were submitted in writing that we didn't get to. What I'd like to do is I'm going to send those to the consultants and ask them if they'd like to weigh in on any of the answers on the written questions we didn't get to, and then we will distribute those responses to the listserv if that's not too great of an imposition if we have enough. Rather than taking up more people's time today, I know everybody's very busy. So with that, I'd like to end and thank everyone for their participation and particularly thank the Office of Rural Health Policy within the Health Resources and Services Administration for their support of this initiative. A transcript of today's call will be made available, and a recording of the call will also be posted on the Office of Rural Health Policy's website. I gave that information out earlier. I want to encourage you to, if you know others who would get value from participating in this service, please make them aware of it. Get them to sign up. There is no charge. There's no registration. To participate, we just ask for their email address so that we can send them information about the series, the questions, and the topics that we're talking about. We are planning another technical assistance call for later this month. We're having some difficulties scheduling with the speaker, so we have not been able to set that date yet, but we hope to have another call dealing with some possible changes in the Rural Health Clinic rules and regulations that may be announced later this year. But we will get information out on that through the RHC listserv. I want to thank everyone for participating. I particularly want to thank all of our experts, Jeff Johnson with Whipley CPAs and Consultants, Ron Nelson with HSA, Health Services Associates. I don't know that Barry Martin was able to make it with MRT Consulting, Charles James with North American Healthcare Management, Glenn Biesink with Midwest Healthcare, and Jim Estes with Healthcare Horizons. I think it was a very good call. I think it was clear that we have a lot of questions and appreciate everybody's time and efforts in helping to educate and answer questions for the RHC community. Thank you, and we'll talk with you next time. Thanks, operator.
This does conclude today's presentation. Thank you for your participation.